I would like to give us a pair of lenses before I talk about the lesson this morning. A pair of lenses that I hope you'll wear for the rest of your life. Let me ask you a question. Do you believe you have a soul? Raise your hand if you believe you have a soul. Well, you're wrong. You don't. You are a soul. You have a body. Now think about that, and I hope you'll think about it the rest of your life. It's the difference all in the world that will make the difference in the way you live your life. You are a soul, and you have a body. Does that make any difference? Does that impact you like it did me when I first learned that? Would you bow in prayer and let's ask God to bless us as we study. Father, we're here as children. We're here as your created beings, as living souls who are wearing these tents that are wearing out and decaying. Would you cause us to be growing inside while we decline and decay outside? And may we draw closer to you each moment that we live. In Jesus' name, amen. How many of you saw The Passion, the movie The Passion? How many of you have already seen it? Okay, well, about millions of others also have. In fact, I heard on television that the intake at the box office exceeded $41 million the first 3 days. And I called Cersei to see if they had attended there, Searcy, Arkansas, and it sold out for the rest of this week. Toward the end of the week, there's some vacancies. So people all over the world are watching it, and I'm thankful to God. I prayed, Lord, let it knock the top out of the box office receipts. Let it just knock the top out. And I think it is, and I think it will continue to. What we saw in the film was the heart of the gospel, the death of Jesus Christ. And that heart of the gospel, his death and his resurrection, if we can emulate that, we'll also be a part of the reason why God created this whole massive scheme. I called a woman last night who was threatening to divorce her husband, and she had made the decision. I said, you've only got one door out of this cycle of ill will and hatred that you're wallowing in. I said, you've only got one door. And that is the door of dying to yourself. Everything else is meaningless unless you take that one door. You'll keep going round and around, and you'll pass that on to your children. But there's only one door left, and that's just this dying to yourself. I don't know whether you've entered that door or not. The film helps us enter the door. And I want to just discuss it with you for a few minutes. We have difficulty accepting it, or we have difficulty grasping the concept. We have a difficulty grasping the idea of the crucifixion for several reasons. It was a Roman custom. It's not an American form of execution. It took place thousands of miles away from us, and then it took place 2,000 years ago. That's three reasons why we're not comfortable with conceiving of and understanding the depth and the intensity of such a type of crucifixion or such a type of execution. Plus the fact that it's horrible beyond comprehension. It's horrible beyond description, even though the film itself has gotten us past that. It can be described, but I don't know that it can be absorbed. I don't think that you and I can absorb the horribleness of that event, even though we saw it depicted, even though we saw it with our own eyes. There's something about it that just simply escapes. It escapes me. I don't know how you feel about it, but I myself have always had difficulty grasping the enormity, grasping the complexity, grasping it emotionally. I used to worry about myself because I found that I would ask myself, what's wrong with you? Why can you not be moved? And until Mel Gibson's film, The Passion, came, I don't think anyone had depicted it so. But even after the film has come and gone, I think that the emotional impact will be only temporary. And we'll forget about the film. We'll get over the shock of it, and it was shocking, but we'll get over it. I think it's temporary. Any kind of emotional experience like that is as temporary as our emotions are temporary. What is to make it so that it has a lasting effect? I'm going to ask you a question, and this will be the premise of just this few minutes this morning. In fact, the film made me redo. I had something else planned entirely different, but I couldn't preach on anything. After that film, what do you do after a film like that? It reminds me of when I was in Canada on September the and just before the Twin Towers were hit. I was in a meeting there. We watched the Twin Towers being hit by those planes. It blew the whole meeting out of the water. I couldn't preach. They couldn't hear. That's somewhat like this film. What do you say after viewing a film like this that we viewed this week? Here's the question. Is it not in the life of Jesus Christ that his death has any meaning? Is that not where the real power of the cross? It's not in the horribleness. If it had been in the horribleness, then the film would have pushed us over the edge. And it did push a lot of people over the edge. But I still say, unless you see the death of Jesus Christ in light of his life, it won't last. It'll be a fleeting emotion. Unless we see in his death his life, and unless we can set the death of Jesus Christ in the context of his life, it won't mean much to us. Do you understand what I'm saying? That the event stands out. I can't grasp it. It's too enormous. And the film did not reduce it to the degree that I can grasp it. I can't do that. It's kind of like asking me to go out and get my arms around the Expo Center. Have you ever seen anything any bigger than that? I'm parked right next to it, and I look out over there, and I see this huge silver dome. And yesterday, I thought, well, I'm going to go see if I can get in there and look at it. But asking me to put my arms emotionally around the cross of Jesus Christ as it sits down as it did with a jolt after, and it tearing his flesh, I can't grasp that. But I tell you what I can grasp. And this is the only way I can understand and grasp the death of Jesus Christ. I can grasp the way he treated the thief that was beside him while he was dying. I can grasp that. I can understand it. And I think that that's the hand. He's kind of like the handle on the door into the cross for me. The cross, I can't grasp it. But the way Jesus treated that poor thief while he was on the cross, he's like a door handle. It's like the door handle into the Expo Center. I can't get my arms around the Expo Center. If you were to take me out there and say, okay, Woodruff, we want you to put your arms around the Expo Center, and I'd say, you've got to be kidding. I'm not Plastic Man. You know, I can't do that. I'm not made like that. I'm connected here and I'm connected here. I can't get my arms around it. And you may have said, oh, well, we should have known better than bring you down here as an interim anyway. But then you come up and say, well, there's a door there into it, and there's a door knob on it. You think you can open the door and walk through? Well, I said, I think I can do that. I did yesterday. I walked in and I stood there aghast at the enormity of that huge colossus standing there, and I just was amazed at it. The thief does that for me. He's my door handle into the death of Jesus Christ. Because the thief is an exact replica. He is a what you would call a miniature. He is a miniature replica of what Jesus did when he died on the cross. Now I'm just going to let that sink in for a moment. The thief is he's a replication. He's an illustration of what it means for Jesus when he died on the cross for the whole world. I can't grasp the bigger picture. I can as I focus in on that one action where he told that dying thief who had not a show of receiving any grace or kindness or mercy or consideration. We don't know his name. We don't know how he looked. He was nameless. He was faithless. He was worthless. He was faceless. He was faithless until he finally it dawned on him. This man doesn't deserve to be here. And he turned to him and he said, Jesus, remember me when you come in your kingdom. And then with what little breath Jesus had left, he turned to the man and he said, today, you'll be with me in paradise. I cannot deny that. I can't get away from it. I learned this about 30 years ago. He became the door handle and the door into the cross of Jesus Christ. And it introduces us into a whole new dimension. And that whole new dimension is simply this. Jesus was always laying down his life for people. He was always laying down his life for people. That's what makes the cross so meaningful to me. It was in the way that he lived that his death means anything. You see, there were two other men crucified that day. There were two men, one on each side of him. But their deaths don't mean a thing for you and me. But the fact that Jesus, the way he lived his life, makes the way he died so meaningful and makes his death so meaningful. Jesus was always laying down his life for other people. While he was there on the cross, the thief is the most outstanding example, and I picture him as on the cross where he was. I picture that's a place where Jesus gave himself for that man. How precious is your breath when you're strapped or hung or nailed to a cross? Your breath is probably the most important thing for you. You die from asphyxiation. That's the way a thief, or that's the way a person who's crucified dies. He dies from asphyxiation before he dies from blood loss. He can't breathe. He can't stand. He can't get air into his lungs. And for Jesus to take what little air he had left and form these words, today you'll be with me in paradise, that is an astonishing way for a person to go out. It's an astonishing way for him to sacrifice himself. While he was there, he also prayed for those who were executing him. One of those crosses, there are many crosses back through his life. And if you'll just think of the cross on which he died as this major cross, then think about all these little crosses back through his life that represent the places where he laid his life down for people. And I think we'll be able to understand what his death means when he really died on the cross. He prayed for his executioners. I think probably when he said, Father, forgive them, they don't know what they're doing. I think more than praying for the Romans and those soldiers, those privates and corporals, maybe and lieutenants who killed him, they didn't know what they were doing. But they weren't the ones that put him there. They were the ones that executed him. But the ones that put him there, I think he was praying for them even. For those rulers of that nation, the Jewish nation, of that time, I think he was praying even for those men who knew but wanted the glory from men more than they wanted the glory from God. I think he was praying for them, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Then you've got people on the other end of the religious spectrum who were the social outcasts. They were the sinful woman, the woman in John 8 when she was brought in. He was sitting there in the temple teaching the people. And here came this stream of, they looked like, I don't know what, in their black robes and all, and all their finery. And they had this woman clothed in a bed sheet. And here they brought her in. They wouldn't have touched her, of course. They were doing her with a cattle prod, probably, because they wouldn't dare touch this sinful woman. And they brought her in and made her stand or sit there or kneel before Jesus. And they said, this woman, we caught in the act of adultery. Now the law says, stone her. What do you say, Jesus? They thought they had him. It was a setup. It was a trap, baited. They thought they had him. He stooped down and began to just doodle in the sand or write something in the sand. And they kept on pressing him. And you can just almost see them nudge each other and say, he doesn't know the answer. If he says stone her, he's in trouble with the Romans. If he says don't stone her, he's in trouble with the law. We've got him either way he turns. And they kept saying, come on, Jesus. Come on, Jesus. And they'd nudge each other and say, we've got him. He doesn't know the answer. Watch him stalling. And you know the story. He looked up and said, well, let him that's without sin among you throw the first stone. And he stooped back down and started to write. Listen to this. when he first stooped down and began to write, you know what he did? He took their attention off the woman and put it on himself. And when she was there, everyone was staring at her, you know. But when Jesus began to do this writing in the sand, I don't doubt what they were saying. What is he doing? And he took their attention off of her and put it upon himself. He'd rather appear a fool than to let them persecute that poor, guilty adulteress. Wow. And then watch what else he did. He said, let him that's without sin cast the first stone. And you know what he could have done? He could have just stood there with his hands on his hips and stared them down. But he didn't even do that. He stooped back down and let them go out without his having to stare them out. He just started doodling again. But watch what he did. He put himself in between those people who were persecuting her. He put her in between the oppressors and the oppressed. He put himself in between the two. And that's what he was always doing all through his life. He was always putting himself in between the oppressors and the oppressed. In between the victims and the villains. Every B-grade movie that we've ever made has somebody coming in to rescue some poor widow from some greedy landowner who wants to throw her out. And here comes the man in the white hat on the white horse, and he comes in and says, you're not going to treat her like that. Jesus was that person who always came in and stood between the oppressor and the oppressed. Oh, there's so many stories, and don't you love those stories? Zacchaeus, another one, the man that was in the up in the tree in Jericho. Jesus was on it about 10 days before he was executed. He came through Jericho, saw Zacchaeus up in the tree, and said, Zacchaeus, come on, I'm going home with you today. Well, the gasping in the crowd, they said, he's gone in to be the guest of a man that's a sinner. He sacrificed his reputation. Oh, it was already gone. It had been gone years ago before he ever did that. But it just confirmed the fact that, here he is again, going around associating with sinners, eating with sinners. He sacrificed his reputation over and over and over again. And then there were just a host of other people. The sick, remember the man that had the withered hand? And he said, come up here and stand in front of everybody. It was Saturday now, it was a Sabbath. He said, stand up here. And then he said, stretch out your hand. After he had asked them, is it right to do good or do evil on the Sabbath? And they wouldn't answer him. And he looked around upon them with anger. And he said, stretch out your hand. He stretched it out, and it was cured. Or the woman, I think it's in Luke 13. This was also on a Sabbath. It was during one of their synagogue meetings. And here she had been now. She was afflicted with scoliosis. That would be the medical term for it. She couldn't straighten up. She was bent over. She had to spend her life looking at belt buckles and sashes. That's as far as she could get. And she was that way not for 18 days or 18 hours or 18 months. She had been that way for 18 years. 18 years. I tell you what, let's just all stand that way for just 18 minutes. We've got about, 18 minutes ought to do it. You don't want to do that? Just 18 minutes. Oh, my. She couldn't stand up for 18 years. And that old, when Jesus said, he said, you're released from your infirmity. And she stood up, and I know what she said. Whoo-wee, that feels good. Oh. And that old hypocrite of a leader he said, I've got an announcement to make. Now, if you want to be healed, come on one of the days other than the Sabbath. There are 6 days we ought to work. Jesus said, you hypocrite. You hypocrite. This woman has been bound for 18 years by Satan. He said, there's not a one of you here who, when he loosens his ox upon the Sabbath day to lead it away to water, there's not a one of you here that will decline to do that. This woman has been bound for 18 years. should she not be loosed on the Sabbath? And it said that his opponents were embarrassed. Well, I should think so. In fact, the word is used, they all felt humiliated. Jesus didn't humiliate people, really. They humiliated themselves. But he sure fixed the noose and let them hang themselves on this occasion. And on these occasions that were done on the Sabbath day, it said they went out and made plans to kill him, because he stood in between the ones that were the oppressors and the ones who were being oppressed. Oh, the mothers and daddies, the old people, he took up for the aged people as well. They said one day to the Pharisees, said to him, "Why do your disciples break the tradition of the elders by not washing their hands before they eat?" And there's a lot in that. It was not just washing your hands like this. They went through what has become our surgical procedure. They washed the hands and then had somebody pour water. And you know how they do when they go into surgery? That's the king that originated with the Jewish nation. And Jesus and his disciples didn't do that. And in one place, in a Pharisee's house, Jesus didn't wash his hands. I don't know whether he didn't wash them at all, but the man was astonished. But anyway, they said, "Why are your disciples breaking the tradition of the elders by not washing their hands before they eat?" And Jesus said, "And yes, and why are you breaking the law of God by your traditions? For the law said, honor your father and mother. But you say, if a man has some money and he says to his mother and father, well, that wherewith you would have been benefited by me has been corbaned. It's been given to God. You don't allow him to honor his father or mother." You know, it's like they would have said, "Well, Mama," or she'd call him up on the phone, he'd call her up and say, "Look, is Dad there?" "Yeah." "Well, okay. Dad, I'm sorry, I can't send you the rent money this month. All my funds are tied up in CDs. Corban deposits." "Oh. Oh, yeah." "Or in TSA, I got a few in TSAs too. Temple sheltered annuities." "Oh, I see. It's just a matter of cash flow." "Rubbish. Said you're a bunch of hypocrites. Isaiah was right when he said, this people draws near me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me." Yeah, he took care of the old folks. And you know when he went into the temple and drove out those who were changers of money and selling doves and selling animals, and he went in there and it was like a bazaar. And he made a whip. It was an intentional. He made a whip when he came from Bethany. How are we doing? He came from Bethany. He spent the night with Mary and Martha and Lazarus there in Bethany and came back in the next morning with this whip. He had been in there earlier the day before on Monday. On Sunday he had been in there. He came, spent Sunday night in Bethany, came in on Monday with this whip made out of leather cords. And I know where he got it. He got it from Martha. Mary wouldn't have known where nothing was. But Martha, if he'd asked Mary, "Where do you have any long strips of leather?" She'd say, "I don't know, Lord." If you asked Martha, she'd say, "Yeah, look in there in the closet behind the first broom and up on the second shelf." That was Martha. And he made this whip and started driving out the people who were taking advantage of the poor people. Jesus stood between those who were oppressing and those who were being oppressed. And he went in there and he didn't make any bones about it. You could buy an animal, or you could bring an animal to sacrifice, but it had to be inspected and approved by the priest. Oh, well, they had them by the neck. You couldn't bring an animal if it was not approved. You couldn't offer it. Now, they would find some defect in it if you brought your own. You know how much it cost you to buy one from them that was already approved? Seven times as much as it cost to buy one out in the street somewhere that was just as good. And he knew what was going on. He said, "You've made my father's house a den of thieves." And he came in there and started flipping tables, money going everywhere, sheep going this way, cattle going that way, doves. He said, "Get these things out of here." And John has him recorded as saying, "How dare you turn my father's house into a market?" And they were so stunned at the audacity of this man who would so put his life on the line as to challenge the Sadducean leadership of the temple where all of the enormous amounts of money was generated. And he came in there and flipped those tables and let it be known, you're not going to turn my father's house into a den of thieves. You're going to stop cheating these people. Well, that's all it took. When you touched their money strings, they went aside and started making definite plans to kill him. He laid his life down for the poor. He laid his life down for the aged. He laid his life down for the social outcast, for the people who were out of the rank sinners. Now, do you see what I mean? All these were little crosses where he laid his life down long before he got to Golgotha. Now, I'm not making light of his suffering and all on Golgotha. It was necessary. But what I'm saying is, he lived the way he died. That's why his death is so important. That's why it's so valuable or so viable. He lived his life the way he died his death. If he had lived a completely selfish life and then came and claimed to be giving his life for us on the cross, we would have been able to say, oh, rubbish. That makes no sense. But when we see this man who lived the way he died, what he demonstrated on the cross, he had already documented 1,000 times in his life before he got to the cross. Don't you love the way his life is such a unit? Don't you love the integrity, how his life was so integrated with everything, how his life was integrated with his death, and how he lived the way that he died, and how he died the way he lived? That's what gets a hold of me. I can't get away from it. I cannot get loose from it. I just can't. And I don't want to. I don't want to get loose from it. You kids, there isn't anybody you can make your hero like Jesus of Nazareth. Nobody. There isn't anybody else like him. Now, there's a caveat to this, and something I want to just mention as we extend the invitation. Just as Jesus' death can only be understood in the context of his life, you know, when he calls us to follow him, it's the same dynamic. Listen, you're invited, anyone here, we've all probably experienced something else that's difficult to understand, and that's our baptism. It's difficult to understand our baptism. They look at us and we come up from the wall. We dress up in some clothes that aren't even ours. They fit like a tent over a... And then we go down into the water and then we disappear. And then we're raised up looking like a drenched rat. To me, that is... How do you explain that to people who are watching? How do you explain that to folks in the world? You've done what? You're going to do what? Well, that's the silliest thing I ever heard. Why are you going to do that? Listen, just as Jesus' death will not be able to be easily understood outside the context of his life, so those who follow Jesus, your baptism and my baptism will only make sense in the light of our lives. If what they see after we're baptized makes no sense by the way we live our lives of crucified living, it won't mount a hill of beans. My dad preached till he preached for 70 years before he died. He was down in Alabama. And he came back and he had baptized one of two twins. And he came back the next year and held the meeting and went to the other twin and said, you know, your brother was baptized last year. The brother said, yeah. But he ain't no different. Oh, his baptism hadn't meant a thing to this brother because he ain't no different. He hadn't died. He hadn't surrendered his life to Jesus. So here's the lesson for us. As we look at Jesus, do you want to understand his death? Look at the way he lived his life. Do you want to understand your baptism? You want to understand your death? Look at the way you live your subsequent life. I know when I was young, I was baptized, And they could say to me, yeah, but he ain't no different. And then when I was 18, I decided, you know what? You've got to bring a dead person to the waters of baptism. You can't bring a live person, man. You've got to bring a dead one. And I know that different people bloom at different times. I'm not trying to get anybody. I just wanted you to know that our death, as we demonstrate the death of Christ in our own baptism, as we say, I'm dying to the world and I want to be united with you, it's going to be seen and understood only in the context of the way we live our lives afterwards. The way Jesus lived his life before his death vindicated him. The way we live our lives after our death vindicates us and validates us.